Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello and welcome to the Being Human podcast. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and today I'm joined by YB Syed Saddiq, a Malaysian politician and the founding member of the Malaysian United Democratic Alliance, also known as MUDA. Saddiq has served as the Member of Parliament for MOA since May 2018 and as Minister of Youth and Sports from July 2018 to February 2020. He is currently the sole MUDA MP and continues to be the president of MUDA since its founding in September 2020. Saddiq is a young and dynamic leader who has made significant contributions during his time in public service. He's known for his passion for youth empowerment and has been involved in youth development programs. He is also a renowned debater and has won a few awards for his debating skills. So I'm hoping we'll be on the same team today as we talk about youth mental health in Malaysia. Welcome to the show, Saddiq. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you very much for inviting me on your platform.
All right. So let's jump right into it. Why public service? You know, what led you to this path, which on the outside to me seems very stressful and not always rewarding.
I mean, it wouldn't be that stressful if you see public service as your personal calling. I'm quite lucky because my mom was a public servant and dedicated her life to public service. She was a teacher until her final days of retirement. And I saw her as someone who took pride in teaching and in being a good public servant. And one of the most vivid memories of my mom is when, because she'll always drive me back home, is that she will stop by a nearby Caltex petrol station, not to fill up petrol, but usually that's where there'll be a few kids who will be selling fruits, sweets, illegally, of course, nearby. But my mom will call them up and ask them to introduce my mom to their parents. And these kids will think like they were in trouble, but my mom actually just wanted to call their parents and offer free tuition for them so that they can get their family out of poverty through education. And when I see that, it actually inspired me and made me realize in the smallest of ways, it's not just through major policy decisions, in the smallest of ways, everyone can contribute in making this world a better place. And public service is a noble job, while may not compensate in a major way in terms of financially. However, if you see public service as your calling, I believe it will be truly rewarding and I take great pride in serving my country.
I mean, you're right. It is an inspiring and your mom served you as a model for you at such a young age. Yeah. Reaching out to the community. Why didn't you become then an educator? You know, like, that a path for you to just, okay, you know, mom did that, I can do that too.
I mean, I've always wanted to be an educator. And to be honest, I mean, I don't plan to practice politics for the rest of my life. I do want to get back to teaching. I mean, before I joined full-time politics, I was a part-time lecturer, the youngest part-time lecturer in my university. I was also a debate trainer. At the same time, I had the privilege and opportunity to teach debating and public speaking in almost 20 to 25 countries. So teaching is in my blood. I mean, obviously, I got it from my mom. And that was my first career choice, to be honest, to be a lecturer. However, when politics happened, obviously, there was a major turning point. But today, at least, I'm part of the select committee in Parliament to reform our public education system. So while I may not be able to pursue my dream to become a teacher and a lecturer, today I'm able to impact policymaking to make the lives of teachers, lecturers, parents, and children better, and overall make our education system a world-class education system.
That sounded like that should be a platform speech already. It was very good and inspiring to make it a world-class. I mean, and it's true. I think one thing that I've noticed since starting Relate about like 7 years ago is that sometimes we have this mindset that, you know, Malaysia can never be as good as others. right? And like, well, we don't have the same expertise, we don't have the same thing. And it's kind of this vicious cycle, because sometimes we maintain a low standard, or we're satisfied with low standard because we can't attain a higher standard. And that perpetuates itself. And then we're always looking towards the West for that's the way, you know, that's going to lead us, as if the leadership can never be, you know, from Southeast Asia, you know, from Malaysia, from African countries. It always has to be Western centric.
I completely agree with that. To be honest, I mean, I don't see Malaysia ever becoming a failed state, but I think now we are too comfortable being stuck in the middle. I mean, at one point in time, we were ahead of South Korea, but today we are like losing out. And Malaysia is no longer the destination of choice, whether it's about high quality investments or even as basic as concerts, because in the end, Malaysia will often get skipped. So I think there's a lot of potential. We have a largely young population, which is bilingual and trilingual, very hardworking, innovative, decent public infrastructure and decent access to tertiary education. So, I mean, overall, I think we have the recipe for success, but I think complacency leads us to be stuck in the middle. I think Malaysia should be the leader in Southeast Asia, should be the example or the success story of a Muslim majority country, which is still largely moderate and celebrate diversity. I think there's a lot in which Malaysia can do to really be the leader of Southeast Asia and of the Muslim world.
It takes a lot of passion, self-confidence. I mean, that's what's really striking me here, is that belief, right? That this is where we want to head to, and that you are the person or one of the people to bring us there. Is that how you see yourself? It's like, yes, this is where we want to go. And I believe, because you call it a calling, right? Yeah. That I've been called to do this. And, you know, you, as you said, you know, you're the youngest of many. You have one of your accomplishments is being the youngest in many positions. And as a young person, that's super stressful, you know, and we went through a lot of political turmoil too. So what was it like for you from wanting to be an educator, like, you know, and part-time lecturer to bam, you know, then you're a minister. And then you're an MP, then you're leading a city. Yeah.
The baptism of fire, right? I mean, you are put through the pressure cooker and it's either you survive or you crash. And to be honest, I think the experience which I've gone through the past 5 years have really matured me politically for like 30 years, because it's like crash course after the other, right? From being the youngest minister to then being confronted with a principled decision whether to stick or stay in government and maintain my comfortable ministerial position or leave, take the difficult path, but a more principled path without needing to forget my ideals and values, and then picking the difficult path and then being offered again another ministerial positions and very comfortable GLC positions in government, rejecting it, and then after rejecting it, then come the threat if I were not to jump ship, overcoming those threats against me and my family members, and then setting up a new political party, which is run like a political startup, a lean and mean political machine, not, you know, via the multi-million-dollar... I mean, really, we don't have a full-time staff, but we have an army of volunteers. My house is now the office. I mean, everything is done online and we are powered by volunteers, not by a patronage structure. So I think it's been really a lot of crash course, a lot of trial and error. However, I think those experiences have made me a better person. I know what I want. I love this country. I know what this country needs. Which is not Syed Saddiq. This country needs strong institutions. I'm merely a vehicle to build on those strong institutions. But really the dream to make Malaysia a developed country is to ensure that our institutions are so resilient, independent and strong that whoever comes into power, even the worst version of a Malaysian being put into power, Malaysia will still be on the right path, will still be moving forward, because in the end, it's not about personalities. It's not about Syed Saddiq. It's not about hyper-partisanship, but it's about building strong, democratic, resilient institutions which supersede personalities like myself and many other leaders.
What was one of the things that, like, it was an unpleasant surprise? And really where I'm coming from is, before starting Relate, and I think many people are in the same position, we have a lot of opinions. We're like, you know what the government should do? And you know what this should do? And then once we go into it, we're like, oh no. Okay, that idea wouldn't work. Okay, so I can see why that is the case. I mean, so that's been my learning curve of understanding the system, but at the same time trying to improve the system. But I look back and go, okay, so I was quite naive, right? I mean, which is good. Is it the passion? I love that sort of naive passion, because that's the recipe for anything moving forward. But what was your maybe unpleasant surprise?
When I realized that a lot of those who were very principled, when they were in power, they abandoned it. Mm-hmm. And then realizing that you need a good team. It's not just about the leader. And hopefully that team will be strong enough and will have the political will to change institutions and laws, which will then enable other more principled leaders to survive in that political system and that new political structure. Because in the end, it's not about that personality. You can have the cleanest, brightest, most talented Malaysian, but if the structures of power are still old politics, old systems, in which there's centralization of power, not enough checks and balances, it corrupts you. And in the end, Malaysia overall suffers. So that's why I keep on stressing back on that system. And I'm hoping that we will be able to overcome that.
How do you trust people after that? You know, I imagine that it's not easy with that unpleasant surprise and realizing that, man, people are not the same, you know, before and after they enter into positions of power. Has that impacted you in any way?
Obviously. I mean, especially when it comes to friendships. However, I try my best to not take things personally. If you take things personally, you will perpetuate that cycle of vendetta and vengeance. And that, to be honest, does a great disservice to fellow Malaysians. I mean, while the political elites fight at the top, it is the average Malaysian who suffers. Because in the end, they just want a good quality job, good income, good public transportation. You know, we care about climate change. They want to see quality access of education for their children and for their grandchildren. They want to retire in a peaceful country. These are all very basic things. And I believe we should be focusing on that. If we take things too personally, and at the same time, we're not mature enough to find a middle path or middle ground via diplomacy, I think the divisions in the country will be made much worse. So while I'm very young, energetic, and at times can be a firebrand, I also know when it is time to find a middle path and a middle ground, as long as it is within the interest of the country, as long as I see that Malaysia is on the right path and that there is a future outlook, which is based on a strong system, which makes our country a developed country.
I really appreciate that, not taking it personally, because it reminds you of who you're working for, right? The people and the office that you hold that is bigger than the person, you know, the personality or the individual. And it is tempting to take things personally because it does feel personal. And politics everywhere tends to make, you know, politicians make personal attacks. Is there a way that you deal with the anger, or do you not feel angry at all? Are you like super zen-like and all the anger disappears in a vacuum internally?
I mean, just to give context, I mean, what my ex-officer did and then in the end became a deputy minister, I mean, it is okay. I mean, that's politics. But one of the biggest things which impacted me, I remember, was my mentor or my ex-mentor, Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin. So he was the one who actually truly brought me into politics. Then I was a youth chief of the party. I was a co-founder of the very same party. And I contested in his neighborhood, which is in Muar. And today I'm still a two-term member of parliament of Muar. And when I was made a minister, he recommended my name. However, when he betrayed the public mandate by jumping ship midway through the term, I disagreed. And I disagreed on a matter of principle, nothing personal against him. But when I didn't support him, despite all the offers made, become minister, chairman of GLCs, then came the threats against me and my family member. And it was very personal because, you know, I was dragged to court. My family was threatened to be dragged to court with me as well. And it was on an internal party matter, which is about an internal party funding SOP. And obviously, it's under his jurisdiction because he's the president of the party and also the prime minister who's in charge of the anti-corruption unit. But instead of, you know, holding grudges and taking it personally, I mean, how does that make my life better? Or how does that make the lives of Malaysians better? Right? It doesn't. That's why I think we need to break that cycle of vengeance and vendetta. How I deal with it? One, you need to know that your conscience is clear. So if you know you did nothing wrong, so what? Just take this as another, you know, confrontation or another challenge which you will have to overcome. As long as you know that your heart is in the right place, as long as you know that you are in the right, there's nothing to fear. Secondly, I think it's also to have different stress coping mechanisms daily. It's not just a, you know, when crisis hits, only then you apply those stress coping mechanisms. I have my daily schedule where I work out 3 times a day, not long, about 30 minutes. And then I do a lot of reading. I listen to my audiobook, which is The Economist weekly magazine. I go jogging. I mean, I hang around with my friends a lot, either online or offline. So, and I'm very privileged to have a very good family support structure. My parents are unbelievably supportive. So I think different people have different coping mechanisms. I also have my cats, 2 wonderful children who are cats. So I think I schedulize it. I schedulize it daily so that in the end, even when crisis hits, not to say I'm immune, but it doesn't break me down like how it would have maybe 5-6 years ago.
And it's almost like you created for yourself a cushion, right? And like maintaining either practice, daily practices, but that support network. So when all these things happen, you can fall back on it. And it's like a softer landing rather than, breaking. I want to switch to youth mental health because I'm into mental health. What comes across in what you said seems to this idea of resiliency, you know, like difficult things happen that I'm sure were emotionally, psychologically affected you a lot, but you seem to be bouncing back. And today, you know, there's this quite pejorative term to describe young people as the strawberry generation. And do you think that's true? And that this generation is a strawberry generation, that they can't take stress at all? What do you think? That's why they have such poor mental health,
I take a completely opposite viewpoint. I don't think this is a strawberry generation. I think we are a sandwiched generation, especially in Malaysia. We are going through a different crisis time. Maybe back then it's about war and conflicts. Today, we are expected to work 2 or 3 different jobs a month in order for us to make ends meet. Wages are not progressing enough. Cost of living is increasing. We are expected to work long hours. I mean, especially the Asian culture, you start early in the morning and finish late night. Even then, you still cannot go back in peace. You have to sell things online. You have to do a different part-time job via the gig sector. And above and beyond that, even then, you can just start, you know, a small family. But then you also realize that your parents' generation will retire without having a proper retirement fund. So in the end, not only are we pressured from the bottom where we want to try start our own lives, but above and beyond that, we're also expected to take care of our parents. And we are also a very asset-like generation. We cannot afford to own a house like our parents in their early 30s. We cannot afford to even buy a car. So everything is rental, rental, and more rental with more interest. So I actually think our generation is a sandwich generation, pressure from top to bottom. So much expectations. We have to be super resilient and diligent, take up multiple jobs just to make ends meet. And it is not easy. It is really not easy. So that's why I take a completely different viewpoint. Whenever someone tells me, you have it easy, young people today, you're not going through wars and conflicts. I mean, we went through COVID. Might be different, but let's not forget, COVID kills more than the biggest wars in the world. So we went through multiple different challenges. And I believe, but this is where I get slightly more optimistic, and pardon me if I'm quoting from a singer, what doesn't kill you make you stronger. Because I actually think we are very resilient, and we'll get stronger from here.
What about like those people who don't bounce back, you know, who do develop depression or anxiety? Then would you say that they are not resilient?
Oh, no, they are resilient. It's just that different people have different coping mechanisms, and different people take pressure points differently. And that's why mental health is the number one issue among youth of today. I mean, the numbers do not lie. Whether it's on increase in attempted suicide or suicide cases, whether it's on the number of youth affected either by anxiety or depression. I mean, it's real. It's very real. It affects the generation of today. And that's why I think it is one of the major youth issues of today. And if we do not address it properly, whether it's through public health infrastructure or through a more compassionate and caring society, which treats mental health as a real issue, not as something made up, you know, because you are weak, because you want to get a free MC, you do not want to go to work, you do not want to go to university, so you say you are suffering from depression. I mean, the misperception on mental health is real. So I think a society which is more compassionate, caring, which invests more in mental health infrastructure and have more caring dialogues on mental health will be one which will be truly resilient.
Let me push on that. So I studied a lot for mental health, 10 years from a PhD. So then I just did my public health, and I've run Relate for 7 years in Malaysia. And I agree with you, mental health is important, but there seems to be not a lot of concrete movement on it, you know, like to really improve mental health, youth mental health, you know, or just generationally mental health in Malaysia. It seems more trendy. I think people are talking about it more. But push come to shove, I think investment is still low, right? Things are still scattered. Like, stigma is still there. People say, we support mental health. Here's another campaign. And I'm like, no more. I agree. We need more awareness, but we need to look at what comes after awareness. So why do you think there's this, you know, we're so stuck, right? It's so important. It is killing people. It is destroying families, futures. People are suffering, but we're moving at a snail pace.
I think in general, today people know about mental health. And while they may be some who are in denial mode, but I think in general, society knows about it. And regardless of partisanship, they care about it. However, translating that care to funding infrastructure or upskilling and reskilling, that's still absent. I give a very simple example. In Malaysia, despite the fact the mental health awareness programs, discussions is nationwide, but it is not a nationwide issue. You still see the ratio of psychologists and psychiatrists to the population being very low, way below the global average. We also see private insurance companies not including mental health into their network of offerings. We also see in schools and universities, counselors not being properly trained on how to deal with students who suffer from depression, anxiety, and mental health breakdowns. So in the end, you realize that, yeah, the national discussion is there, but to translate that national discussion into concrete policy frameworks, safety nets, additional funding, I think that's still lacking. But that's where I believe, as you have more young people in, because this is also a generational issue, I think you'll see a quicker change because it affects all of us the most.
I think younger people will probably focus on it more. But, you know, suicide also impacts, you know, old people a lot. So you do see that dip, that peak among the 20s and then among the 70s. And that's one thing that, you know, geriatric care, mental health care is really also being overlooked.
Yep.
Your party is named Muda. What are you going to do about the tour?
Muda, in and of itself, is about bringing new politics, which cuts across different identities, whether it's race, religion, age. I mean, our oldest member is 92 years old. We are open to all. We want to be the most diverse political party in Malaysia. We not only want to tolerate diversity, we want to celebrate it. So we're actually open to all. It's just that it is youth-centered. I mean, because a lot of us are very young. We want to try set up a new political force. So a lot of our leaders are young, but our membership is open to all. So what I'm going to do for tour, I mean, again, as I shared, to make Malaysia a developed country, you cannot just help young people, you have to help all. I just shared just now that the majority of the older generation today do not even have enough savings for their retirement. I mean, heck, in Malaysia, the average retirement fund for someone who's about to retire is 10,000 ringgit. I mean, you can't even survive for 1 year post-retirement. And that's worrying because who will then be expected to take care of you? It's either taxpayers, which again is very tough, will most likely be your children, who at the moment is already suffering from increasing cost of living, being an asset-light generation, very stagnant wages. So I think it's about helping that generation live a quality life post-retirement. And there's a lot of work to be done there.
I think that's my hypothesis, is that why it's been so hard to change mental health or to make some concrete policy decisions there, changes in mental health, is we don't have a lot of support top-down. And the conversation is always us versus them, right? Like, if you people
got problem, and you people stress, you know, then you go talk to a counselor, and you people should have gone and see a psychiatrist. Why you people never seek help? And there's still, you know, I work with really great advocates and politics and community organizations, but very few actually say we are suffering, and I saw a psychiatrist or I saw a psychologist. Do you think that would ever happen in our lifetime, or is that, you know, why aren't people identifying with that? Why aren't people, because we can see that, you know, in Australia, in the UK, in the US, that makes a huge difference, right? People identifying with the issue, it destigmatizes. It's about the contact with someone who is in the same boat, but continuing their journey of recovery in what seems to be a successful way.
I mean, I'm not sure that this is the conventional Asian culture, which promotes hyper performance, less tolerant to mistakes and weaknesses, which then pushes people into pressure cookers and without accepting failure. So, which makes it much harder to share. You know, this is private. Oh no, this is just in your mind. You're just making it up. Don't worry, toughen it out. It's that kind of mentality. Yeah, I don't know whether it applies. It is just in general in Asian culture. But that's definitely true in Malaysia, I can tell you. I mean, cut across different races. So that's where I think breaking the stigma is very important and getting a lot more people, not just to talk about it. So you cannot just run typical campaigns. You need to get friends and family members to talk about it. Because again, you cannot talk to the random doctor you see in front of your school who comes to give a one-off in a year session, you know, kind of talk. But when you speak to your brother, your sister, your mom, your dad, closer to you, more intimate relationship becomes better for you to open up. So that relatability, that identification will take a little bit of time. But I personally think it will be turbocharged in the next 5 to 10 years because we cannot afford to just hide this issue under the rug anymore. There will be systematic changes to it.
Mm-hmm. So finally, you, as I said, you come across very resilient. I don't want our listeners to think, well, this sadik guy, sure, everything he thought about mental health, but he's so super strong, you know, and look at me, I'm the one suffering. So what would you say to those who need support, who don't feel like they can bounce back, who are really having a difficult time, but they feel like seeking help is a sign of weakness?
Firstly, you are not alone. I mean, while I've overcome many challenges, to say that I've not suffered from breakdowns and anxiety attacks, I mean, it's not true. I've gone through it and it was not easy. You know, where you just wake up randomly in the middle of the night, having shivers and then not being able to go back to sleep. I mean, I've had many of those nights. However, I'm still largely privileged because I have a good family support system, different stress coping mechanisms. Not to say I'm perfect, but now I think to some extent I'm a lot more resilient. But just because you don't have the same stress coping mechanisms or just because you don't bounce back as fast does not make you in any way inferior. Now, if anything, we have different ways of coping, we have different ways of dealing with stress. My hope is that you at least have someone close, whether it's a family or friend, to talk to, because at times not everyone feels comfortable talking to an expert or can reach out to an expert. But at least having a family or friend to open up and to share your experiences and your thoughts in a judgment-free zone, I think would help, because I had that. And that's one of the best ways to cope with it. And I hope that in the smallest of way, no matter where you are at, no matter who you are, you have friends and family members who you can speak to openly.
All right. Thank you, Sadik, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.